insane. On the other hand, while Blanche only seems passive, the truly passive protagonist is a regrettably common mistake. A story cannot be told about a protagonist who doesn't want anything, who cannot make decisions, whose actions affect no change at any level. Rather, the protagonist's will impels a conscious desire. The protagonist has a need or goal, an object of desire, and is conscious of it. The protagonist knows what he or she wants. However, the most memorable, fascinating characters tend to not have only a conscious, but an unconscious desire. Although these complex protagonists are unaware of their subconscious need, the audience senses it, perceiving in them an inner contradiction. The conscious and unconscious desires of a multidimensional protagonist contradict one another. What he believes he wants is the antithesis of what he actually but unwittingly wants. This is self-evident. What would be the point of giving a character a subconscious desire if it happens to be the very thing he knowingly seeks? A protagonist has the will and capacity to pursue the object of his conscious and/or unconscious desire to the end of the line, to the human limit established by setting and genre. The art of story is not about the middle ground, but about the pendulum of existence swinging to the limits, about life lived in its most intense states. We explore the middle ranges of experience, but only as a path to the end of the line. And the audience knows that limit, for no matter how intimate or epic the setting, instinctively the audience draws a circle around the characters and their world, a circumference of experience that's defined by the nature of the fictional reality. This line may reach inward to the soul, outward into the universe, or in both directions at once. We then expect the storyteller to be an artist of vision who can take his story to those distant depths and ranges, to a final action beyond which the audience cannot imagine another. The protagonist must be empathetic. He may or may not be sympathetic. Sympathetic means likable. Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan, for example, or Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn in their typical roles. Empathy, however, is a more profound response. Empathetic means like me. Deep within the protagonist, the audience recognizes a certain shared humanity. Character and audience are not alike in every fashion, of course. They may share only a single quality, but there's something about the character that strikes a chord. Sympathy is optional, empathy absolute. At first glance, creating empathy would not seem difficult. The protagonist is a human being. The audience is full of human beings. As the filmgoer looks up on the screen, he recognizes the character's humanity, senses that he shares it, identifies with the protagonist, and dives into the story. Indeed, in the hands of the greatest of writers, even the most unsympathetic character can be made empathetic. Macbeth, for example, viewed objectively, is a monster. He butchers a kindly old king while the man is sleeping, a king who had never done Macbeth any harm. In fact, that very day he'd given Macbeth a royal promotion. Macbeth then murders two servants of the king to blame the deed on them. He kills his best friend. Finally, he orders the assassination of the wife and infant children of his enemy. He's a ruthless killer. Yet, in Shakespeare's hands, he becomes a tragic, empathetic hero. The bard accomplished this feat by giving Macbeth a conscience. As he wanders in soliloquy, wondering, agonizing, why am I doing this? What kind of man am I? The audience listens and thinks, what kind? Guilt-ridden, just like me. I feel bad when I'm thinking about doing immoral things. I feel awful when I do them, and afterwards there's no end to the guilt. Macbeth is a human being. He has a conscience just like mine. A character's world can be imagined as a series of concentric circles surrounding a core of raw identity or awareness, circles that mark the levels of conflict in a character's life. The first circle, or level, is his own self and conflicts arising from the elements of his own nature, mind, body, emotion. When, for example, a character takes an action, his mind may not react the way he anticipates. His thoughts may not be as quick, as insightful, as witty as he expected. His body may not react as he imagined. It may not be strong enough or agile enough for a particular task. And we all know how emotions betray us. So the closest circle of antagonism in the world of a character is his own being, feelings and emotions, mind and body, all or any of which may or may not react from one moment to the next the way he expects. As often as not, we are our own worst enemy. The second circle inscribes personal relationships, unions of intimacy deeper than the social role. Social convention assigns us the outer roles we play. At the moment, for example, we're playing teacher-student. Someday, however, our paths may cross and we may decide to change our professional relationship to friendship. In the same manner, parent-child begins as social roles that may or may not become personal. Many of us go through life in parent-child relationships that never deepen beyond social definitions of authority and rebellion. Not until we set the conventional role aside do we find the true intimacy of family, friends, and lovers, who then do not react the way we expect and become the second level of personal conflict. The third circle marks the level of extra-personal conflict, all the sources of antagonism outside the personal. Conflict with social institutions, cop, criminal, victim, government, citizen, church, worshiper, conflict with individuals, boss, worker, customer, waiter, doctor, patient, and conflict with the environment, both man-made and natural. The protagonist seeks an object of desire beyond his reach. Consciously and or unconsciously, he chooses to take an action motivated by the thought and or feeling that this act will cause the world to react in a way that will create a positive step toward achieving his desire. But the moment he takes this action, from his inner life, personal relationships, the extra-personal world, from any two or all three at once, comes a reaction that's more powerful than he expected, different than he expected, or both. This reaction from his world blocks his desire, thwarting him and bending him further from his desire than he was before he took this action. Rather than evoking cooperation from his world, his action provokes forces of antagonism that open up the gap between his expectation and the result, between what he thought would happen when he took his action and what in fact does happen, between his sense of probability and true necessity. Once the gap in reality splits open, the character, being willful and having capacity, senses or realizes that his world is not what he thought it to be, that he cannot get what he wants the minimal conservative way. He must gather himself and struggle through this gap to take a second action. This next action is something the character would not have wanted to do in the first case, because it not only demands more willpower and forces him to dig more deeply into his human capacity, but most importantly, the second action puts him at risk. He now stands to lose in order to gain. We'd all like to have our cake and eat it too. In a state of jeopardy, on the other hand, we must put at risk something we want or have in order to gain something else that we want or protect something we have. A dilemma we would all strive to avoid. Here's a simple test to apply to your story in progress. Ask, what is the risk? What does the protagonist stand to lose if he or she does not get what he or she wants? More specifically, what's the worst thing that will happen to the protagonist if he or she does not achieve his or her desire? If the answer is not compelling, it's time for a serious rewrite. Examine your own desires. You wish to write for the cinema, the foremost media of creative expression in the world today. You wish to give us works of beauty and meaning that will help shape our vision of reality. In return, you would like to be acknowledged. It's a noble ambition and a grand achievement to fulfill. And because you're a serious artist, you're willing to risk vital aspects of your life in order to live that dream. You're willing to risk time, You're willing to risk humiliation. You're willing to risk people. The writer is willing to risk because his ambition has life-defining force. What's true for the writer is true for every character he creates. The measure of the value of a character's desire is in direct proportion to the risk he takes to achieve it. The greater the value, the greater the risk. The protagonist's first action has aroused forces of antagonism that block his desire. Now he must take a second, more difficult and risk-taking action, an action based on his expectations of the world, an action consistent with his vision of reality. His action, however, springs open a gap between expectation and result, disconfirming his notions of reality, putting him in greater conflict with his world at even greater risk. But the resilient human mind quickly remakes reality into a larger pattern that now incorporates this disconfirmation. So he ups the ante again and makes a decision to take a new action, which he feels is consistent with his new view. He reaches even more deeply into his capacities and willpower, puts himself at greater risk, and takes a third action. Perhaps this action achieves a positive result, and for the moment he takes a step toward his desire. But with his next action, the gap will crack open again. Now he must take an even more difficult action that demands even more willpower, more capacity, and more risk. Over and over again in a progression, rather than cooperation, his actions provoke forces of antagonism, opening gaps in his reality. This pattern repeats on various levels to the end of the line, to a final action beyond which the audience cannot imagine another. These cracks in moment-to-moment reality mark the difference between the dramatic and the prosaic, between action and activity. True action is physical, vocal, or mental movement that turns around gaps in expectation and creates significant change. Mere activity is behavior in which what is expected happens, generating either no change or trivial change. But the gap between expectation and result is far more than a matter of cause and effect. In the most profound sense, the break between the cause as it seemed and the effect as it turns out marks the point where the human spirit and the world meet. On one side is the world as we believe it to be. On the other is reality as it actually is. In this gap is the nexus of story, the cauldron that cooks our tellings. Here the writer finds the most powerful life-bending moments. The only way we can reach this crucial junction is by working from the inside out. Why must we do this? Why, during the creation of a scene, must we find our way to the center of each character and experience it from his or her point of view? Because if you stay outside your characters, you inevitably write emotional clichés. To create honest human reactions, you must not only get inside your character, but inside yourself. To illustrate writing from the inside out, I'll use one of the most famous and brilliantly written scenes in film, the second act climax of Chinatown by screenwriter Robert Towne. Private Detective J.J. Gittes is investigating the death of Hollis Mulray, commissioner of the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power. Mulray has apparently drowned in a reservoir, and the crime baffles Gittes' rival, Police Lieutenant Escobar. Near the end of Act Two, Gittes has narrowed the suspects and motives to two. Either a conspiracy of millionaires led by the ruthless Noah Cross killed Mulray for political power and riches, or Evelyn Mulray killed her husband in a jealous rage after he was found with another woman. Gittes follows Evelyn to a house in Santa Monica. Peering through a window, he sees the other woman, seemingly drugged and held prisoner. When Evelyn comes out to her car, he forces her to talk, and she claims that the woman is her sister. Gittes knows she doesn't have a sister, but for the moment says nothing. The next morning, he discovers what appears to be the dead man's eyeglasses in a saltwater pond at the Mulray home. Now he knows how and where the man was killed. With this evidence, he goes back to Santa Monica to confront Evelyn and turn her over to Escobar, who's threatening to pull Gittes' private investigator's license. To further complicate matters, he's fallen in love with Evelyn Mulray. He finds himself in this predicament because days before the murder, he was duped into investigating Hollis Mulray for adultery. Someone's made a fool of Gittes, and he's a man of excessive pride. Behind his cool demeanor is an impulsive risk-taker. His sarcastic cynicism masks an idealist's hunger for justice. Gittes' scene objective? To find the truth. Evelyn Mulray is the victim's wife and the daughter of Noah Cross. She's nervous and defensive when questioned about her husband. She stammers when her father is mentioned. She is, we sense, a woman with something to hide. She has hired Gittes to look into the murder of her husband, perhaps to conceal her own guilt. During the investigation, however, she seems drawn to him. After a close escape from some thugs, they make love. Evelyn's scene objective? To hide her secret and escape. The scene. Interior, exterior, Santa Monica streets, Buick, moving, day. To work from the inside out, slip into Gittes' mind while he drives to Evelyn's hideaway. Imagine yourself in Gittes' point of view. As the streets roll past the car windows, you ask, if I were Gittes, in this moment, what would I do? Letting your imagination roam, the answer comes. I'd rehearse, as we all rehearse before taking on life's big confrontations. Working deeply into Gittes' psyche, feel your hands white-knuckled on the steering wheel, your thoughts running with Gittes. She killed him, then used me. She lied to me, came on to me. Man, I fell for her. My guts are in a knot, but I'll be cool. I'll stroll to the door, step in, accuse her. She lies. I send for the cops. She plays innocent, a few tears, but I stay ice cold. Show her Mulray's glasses, then lay out how she did it, step by step, as if I saw it happen. She confesses. I turn her over to Escobar. I'm off the hook. Exterior, bungalow, Santa Monica. Gittes' car speeds into the driveway. As Gittes, you're still thinking, I'll be cool, but seeing the house, an image of Evelyn flashes through your thoughts, evoking a sudden anger. A gap cracks open between your resolve and emotions. Your foot slams down. Screech of brakes. You jump out of the car. To hell with her. Slam the door. Let her know you're here. Slam! Feet pounding to the house. Hand grabbing the doorknob. Get her before she can run. Damn, the door's locked. Fist banging on the door. Interior bungalow. Khan, Evelyn's Chinese servant, hears pounding and heads for the door. As other characters enter, shift back and forth from their points of view. Now act the scene from Khan's point of view. If I were Khan at this moment, what would I do? Now, as Khan, you think, who the hell's that? 10-1, that loud-mouthed detective. Paint on the butler's smile. Expecting to handle things, you unlock the door. Huh, I was right. Him. Khan. Dialogue. You wait. Now back in Gittes' thoughts. That snotty butler again. Gittes. Dialogue. You wait. Chao hoi kai dai. As Khan, the sudden gap between expectation and result inverts your smile, thinking, he not only barges in, but insults me in Cantonese. Confusion, anger, throw him out. Evelyn's footsteps behind you. Protect her. Shifting to Evelyn's point of view. If I were Evelyn in this situation, what would I do? You adjust your necklace as you reach the bottom of the stairs. Seeing Gittes, you're glad. You've been calling him, hoping to get his help. After packing all morning, you're in a hell-bent rush to catch the 5:30 train to Mexico. Thinking, it's Jake. I know he cares. He'll help me. How do I look? Hands instinctively flutter to hair, face. Khan looks worried. A reassuring smile to Khan, a gesture, signaling him to leave. Evelyn, dialogue. It's all right, Khan. Glancing back at Gittes, you're thinking, thank God he's here. Now I'm not alone. Evelyn, dialogue. How are you? I've been calling you. Now as Gittes, you turn away, thinking, she's so beautiful. Stay tough, man. Don't look at her. Be ready. She'll tell lie on lie. Gittes, dialogue. Oh, yeah? As Evelyn, searching his face. Something's bothering him. I can't get his eye. Poor man looks tired. Evelyn, dialogue. Did you get some sleep? Gittes, sure. Now as Evelyn. And hungry. I'll feed him a bit of normalcy, please God. Evelyn, dialogue. Have you had lunch? Con can fix you something. Now as Gittes. Lunch? What's this bullshit? Do it now. Gittes. Dialogue. Where's the girl? Now as Evelyn. The gap flies open. Shock rocks you. Why is he asking me that? What does he want with her? What's gone wrong? Evelyn. Dialogue. Upstairs. Why? Now as Gittes. With soft voice. The innocent why. Keep cool. Gittes. Dialogue. I want to see her. Back in Evelyn's thoughts. Don't let him. Lie. Find out first. Evelyn. Dialogue. She's having a bath now. Why do you want to see her? Now as Gittes, disgusted with her lies. Don't let her get to you. Looking around, seeing half-packed suitcases. She's making a run for it. Good I got here. Watch out, she'll lie again. Gittes, dialogue. Going somewhere? Now as Evelyn. Should have told him, but there wasn't time. Can't hide it. Tell the truth. Won't hurt. He'll understand. Evelyn, dialogue. Yes, we have a 5:30 train to catch. Now as Gittes. What do you know? Sounds honest. A minor gap. Doesn't matter. Put an end to her bullshit. Let her know you mean business. Where's the phone? There. Picking it up. Now as Evelyn. Confusion. Choking fear. Who's he calling? Evelyn. Dialogue. Jake. Seeing him dial. Oh, God help me. As Gittes. Ear to the phone. Answer, you creeps. You hear a police secretary pick up. Gittes. Dialogue. J.J. Gittes for Lieutenant Escobar. As Evelyn. A rush of adrenaline hits you. The police. Panic. No, no. Keep calm. Keep calm. It must be about Hollis. But I can't wait. We have to leave now. Evelyn. Dialogue. Look, what's the matter? What's wrong? I told you we have a 5:30 train. As Gittes. Thinking. It's enough. Shut her up. Gittes. Dialogue. You're going to miss your train. Talking into the phone. Lou, meet me at 1972 Canyon Drive. Yeah, soon as you can. As Evelyn, anger rises, but you hold on to a shred of hope, thinking, the fool, but maybe he's calling the police to help me. Evelyn, dialogue. Why'd you do that? Now as Gittes, a smug satisfaction. She's trying to get tough, but I got her now. Feels good. I'm right at home. Tossing your hat on the table. Gittes, dialogue. Know any good criminal lawyers? As Evelyn, your pride stiffens. You try to close the widening gap. Look at him swagger. I slept with him. Paid for his help. Who does he think he is? Evelyn, dialogue. No. As Gittes, so innocent. Well, she'll know some lawyers now. You take a cigarette out of a silver case. Gittes, dialogue. Don't worry, I can recommend a couple. They're expensive, but you can afford it. Back in Evelyn's point of view, you watch Gittes calmly take a lighter out of his pocket, sit down, and light a cigarette. My God, he's threatening me. Don't panic. Handle it. There must be a reason for all this. Your throat tightens in anger. Evelyn. Dialogue. Will you please tell me what this is all about? As Gittes. Angry, huh? Good. Watch this. You slip the cigarette lighter back into your pocket and with the same motion bring out a handkerchief. You set it on the table and carefully pull back the four corners of the cloth to reveal the eyeglasses. Gittes. Dialogue. I found these in your backyard in the pond. They belonged to your husband, didn't they? Didn't they? As Evelyn now, dazed, you can feel the gap, refusing to close. Nothing makes sense. Glasses. In Hollis's fish pond, what's he after? A rising dread of something terrible about to happen. Evelyn, dialogue. I don't know. Yes, probably. As Gittes, an opening. Get her now. Make her confess. You jump up. Gittes. Dialogue. Yes, positively. That's where he was drowned. As Evelyn, you're stunned. Killed at home? Evelyn. Dialogue. What? Now as Gittes, you suppress your fury. Playing that innocent crap to the end. Make her talk. Now. Gittes. Dialogue. There's no time to be shocked by the truth. The coroner's report proves that he had salt water in his lungs when he was killed. Just take my word for it, all right? Now I want to know how it happened, and I want to know why, and I want to know before Escobar gets here, because I don't want to lose my license. As Evelyn, his sneering, livid face pushes into yours. Chaos, paralyzing fear, grasping for control. Evelyn, dialogue. I don't know what you're talking about. This is the craziest, most insane thing. As Gittes, your tough interrogator persona and your emotions part company. A flash of anger, hands shoot out, grasp her, fingers digging in, making her wince. Gittes, dialogue. Stop it. You see the look of shock and pain in her eyes. Another gap opens, a sudden stab of compassion. Feelings for her struggle against your rage. They win for the moment. Your hands drop. She's hurting. Man, she didn't do it in cold blood. Could happen to anybody. So give her a chance. Lay it out for her as if you saw it yourself, but get the truth. Gittes, dialogue. I'm going to make it easy for you. You were jealous. You had a fight. He fell. Hit his head. It was an accident. But his girl's a witness, so you had to shut her up. You don't have the guts to harm her, but you've got the money to shut her mouth. Yes or no? As Evelyn, you feel the gap finally crashing shut with horrible meaning. My God, he thinks I did it. Evelyn, dialogue. No. As Gittes now, hearing her emphatic answer. Good. Finally sounds like the truth. Cooling off. All right, so she's not bribing her. But what the hell's going on? Gittes, dialogue. Who is she? And don't give me that crap about a sister, because you don't have a sister. As Evelyn, now the thoughts rushing as the greatest shock of all splits you in two. He wants to know who she is. God help me. You're weak with years of carrying the secret. Back to the wall. No place to turn except to Gittes. If I don't tell him, the police. If I do... Evelyn, dialogue. I'll tell you. I'll tell you the truth. As Gittes now, feeling confident, focused. At last. Gittes, dialogue. Good. What's her name? As Evelyn now. Her name. Dear God, her name. Evelyn, dialogue. Catherine. Gittes, Catherine who? As Evelyn, you brace for the worst. Tell it all. See if he can take it. If I can take it. Evelyn, dialogue. She's my daughter. As Gittes now, your rage erupts. Your expectation of talking her into a confession explodes. Your hand lashes out, slapping her flush across the face. As Evelyn, you feel searing pain, but you don't react. Weakness, no impulse to strike back. A lifetime of guilt, paralysis. Gittes, dialogue. I said the truth. Evelyn, she's my sister. As Evelyn, you go numb, feeling nothing but a letting go. You stand passively, almost willing him to hit you. As Gittes, you slap her again. Evelyn, dialogue. She's my daughter. As Gittes, you slap her yet again, seeing her tears. Evelyn, dialogue. My sister. As Gittes, you slap her harder. Evelyn, dialogue. My daughter. My sister. As Gittes, backhand, open fist. Then you grasp her, hurl her into a sofa. Gittes, dialogue. I said I want the truth. As Evelyn, his assault at first seems miles away, but the jolt against the sofa brings you back to the now with a flood of fury. The greatest gap imaginable wrenches apart, screaming out words you've never said to anyone. Evelyn, dialogue. She's my sister and my daughter. As Gittes, a blinding gap. You're dumbfounded. Fury ebbs away. Feeling like a fool, you try to close this gap by absorbing the terrible implications behind her words. End of scene. In writing out what actors call inner monologues, I've put this well-paced scene into ultra-slow motion and given words to what would be flights of feeling or flashes of insight. Nonetheless, that's how it is at the desk. It may take days, even weeks, to write what will be minutes, perhaps seconds, on screen. To recap the scene, Gittes knocks on the door, expecting to be let in. What reaction does he get? Khan blocks his way, expecting Gittes to wait. Gittes's reaction? He shocks Khan by insulting him and barging in. Evelyn comes down the stairs, expecting Gittes's help. The reaction to that? Gittes threatens to call the police, expecting to force her to confess the murder and tell the truth about the other woman. Reaction? She reveals that the other woman is her daughter by incest, and with that she accuses her lunatic father of murder. Beat after beat, even in the quietest, most internalized of scenes, a series of action, reaction, gap, renewed action, surprising reaction, gap, builds the scene to and around its turning point as reactions amaze and fascinate. The stuff of story is not its words. Your text must be lucid in order to express the desk-bound life of your imagination and feelings. But the words are not an end, they are the means, a medium. The substance of story is the gap that splits open between what a human being expects to happen when he takes an action and what really does happen. As a charge of electricity leaps from pole to pole in a magnet, so the spark of life ignites across the gap between the pole of self and the pole of reality. With this flash of energy, we ignite the power of story and move the heart of the audience. And now let's look at story objectively, from the outside in. A story is a design in five parts. The inciting incident, the first major event of the telling, is the primal cause for all that follows, putting into motion the other four elements, progressive complications, crisis, climax, resolution. To understand how the inciting incident enters into and functions within the work, we step back to take a more comprehensive look at setting, the physical and social world in which it occurs. We've defined setting in terms of period in time, duration through time, location in space, and the levels of conflict. These four dimensions frame the story's world, but to inspire the multitude of creative choices a writer needs to tell an original, cliché-free story, he must fill that frame with a depth and breadth of detail. How do my characters make a living? What are the politics of my world? What are the rituals of my world? What are the values in my world? What is the genre or combination of genres? With what conventions? As with setting, genres surround the writer with creative limitations that must be kept or brilliantly altered. What are the biographies of my characters? From the day they were born to the opening scene, how has life shaped them? A true author, no matter the medium, is an artist with godlike knowledge of his subject. And the proof of his authorship is that his pages smack of authority. The audience must believe. Or, as Samuel Taylor Coleridge suggested, the audience must willingly suspend its disbelief. Once involved, the writer must keep the audience involved to fade out. To do so, he must convince us that the world of his story is authentic. Authenticity has nothing to do with so-called reality. As Aristotle tells us, for the purposes of a story, a convincing impossibility is preferable to an unconvincing possibility. Even a story set in a world that could never exist could be absolutely authentic. Beyond physical and social detail, we must also create emotional authenticity. Authorial research must pay off in believable character behavior. Beyond behavioral credibility, the story itself must persuade. From event to event, cause and effect must be convincing, logical. The art of story design lies in a fine adjustment of things both unusual and usual to things universal. The writer whose knowledge of subject has taught him exactly what to stress and expand versus what to lay down quietly and subtly will stand out from the thousands of others who always hit the same note. Starting from any premise at any point in the story's chronology, our research feeds the invention of events. The events redirect research. We do not, in other words, necessarily design a story by beginning with its first major event. But at some point, as you author your universe, you'll face these questions. How do I set my story into action? Where do I place this crucial event? When an inciting incident occurs, it must be a dynamic, fully developed event, not something static or vague. In most cases, the inciting incident is a single event that either happens directly to the protagonist or is caused by the protagonist himself. Occasionally, an inciting incident needs two events, a setup and payoff. Jaws. Setup, a shark eats a swimmer and her body washes onto the beach. Payoff, the sheriff discovers the corpse. The inciting incident occurs in only one of two ways, either by decision, a decision made by the protagonist, such as Oskar Schindler's decision to turn his factory into a haven for Jews, or a decision made by someone with the power to affect the protagonist's life, such as Joanna Kramer's decision to leave her husband and child. Or it may occur by coincidence, such as the trucking accident that kills Alice's husband in Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore. But however it occurs, the effect of the inciting incident is to radically upset the balance of forces in the protagonist's life. Consequently, he cannot be ignorant of it. He must react. Given the infinitely variable nature of protagonists, however, any reaction is possible. Even the refusal to act is a reaction. For example, how many westerns began like this? Bad guys shoot up the town and kill the old marshal. Townspeople gather and go down to the livery stable, run by Matt, a retired gunslinger who's sworn a sacred oath never to kill again. The mayor pleads, "Matt, you've got to pin on the badge and come to our aid. You're the only one who can do it." Matt replies, "No, no, I hung up my guns long ago." "But Matt," begs the school marm, "they killed your mother." Matt toes the dirt and says, "Well, she was old, and I guess her time had come." The protagonist can refuse to act, but that itself is a reaction. A refusal to act, however, cannot last for very long. For as the inciting incident first throws the protagonist's life out of balance, it arouses in him the desire to restore that balance. Out of this need, the protagonist next conceives of an object of desire, something physical or situational or attitudinal, that he feels he lacks or needs to put the ship of life on an even keel. Lastly, the inciting incident propels the protagonist into an active pursuit of this object or goal. And for many stories or genres, this is sufficient. An event pitches the protagonist's life out of kilter, arousing a desire for something he feels will set things right, and he goes after it. But for those protagonists we tend to admire the most, the inciting incident not only arouses a conscious desire, but an unconscious one as well. These complex characters suffer intense inner conflict, because these two desires are in direct conflict with each other. No matter what the character consciously thinks he wants, the audience senses or realizes that deep inside he unconsciously wants the very opposite. The Crying Game. Fergus, a member of the Irish Republican Army, is put in charge of a British corporal held prisoner by his IRA unit. He finds himself in sympathy with the man's plight. When the corporal is killed, Fergus goes AWOL to England, hiding out from both the British and the IRA. He looks up the corporal's lover, Dill. He falls in love, only to discover that Dill's a transvestite. The IRA then tracks him down. Fergus volunteered for the IRA, knowing it's not a college fraternity, so when they order him to assassinate an English judge, he must finally come to terms with his politics. Is he or is he not an Irish patriot? Beneath Fergus's conscious political struggle, the audience senses from his first moments with the prisoner to his last tender scenes with Dill that this scene isn't about his commitment to the cause. Hidden behind his zigzag politics, Fergus harbors the most human of needs, to love and be loved. The energy of the protagonist's desire forms the crucial element of design known as the spine of the story. The spine is the deep desire in and the effort by the protagonist to restore the balance of life. It's the primary unifying force that holds all other story elements together. For no matter what happens on the surface of the story, each scene, image, and word is ultimately an aspect of the spine, relating causally or thematically to this core of desire and action. If the protagonist has no unconscious desire, then his conscious desire becomes the spine. The spine of any Bond film, for example, can be phrased as, to defeat the arch-villain. James has no unconscious desires. He wants and only wants to save the world. If, on the other hand, the protagonist has an unconscious desire, this becomes the spine of the story. An unconscious desire is always more powerful and durable, with roots reaching to the protagonist's innermost self. Moby Dick. If Melville had made Ahab sole protagonist, his novel would be a simple but exciting work of high adventure, driven by the captain's monomania to destroy the white whale. But by adding Ishmael as dual protagonist, Melville enriched his story with the complexities of an education plot. For the telling is in fact driven by Ishmael's unconscious desire to battle inner demons, seeking in himself the destructive obsessions he sees in Ahab, a desire that not only contradicts his conscious hope to survive Ahab's mad voyage, but may destroy him as it does Ahab. The inciting incident of the central plot must happen on screen, not in the characters' biographies, not between scenes off screen. The presence of the audience at the central plot's inciting incident is crucial to story design for two reasons. First, when the audience witnesses an inciting incident, the film's major dramatic question, a variation on how will this turn out, is provoked to mind. Jaws, will the sheriff kill the shark or the shark the sheriff? Second, the inciting incident projects an image of the obligatory scene into the audience's imagination. The obligatory scene is an event the audience knows it must see before the story can end. The shark and the sheriff, for example, face to face. Unlike action genres that bring the obligatory scene immediately and vividly to mind, other more interior genres hint at this scene in the inciting incident, then like a photo negative in acid solution, slowly bring it into focus. In Tender Mercies, Max Sledge is drowning in booze and an utterly meaningless life. His ascent from rock bottom begins when he meets a lonely woman with a son who needs a father. He's inspired to write some new songs, then accepts baptism and makes peace with his estranged daughter. Gradually, he pieces together a meaningful life. The audience, however, senses that because the dragon of meaninglessness drove Sledge to rock bottom, it must once again rear its gruesome head. That the story can't end until once again he's slapped in the face with the cruel absurdity of life, this time with all its soul-destroying force. The obligatory scene comes in the form of a hideous accident that kills his only child. If a drunk needed an excuse to pick up the bottle again, this would do. Indeed, his daughter's death plunges Sledge's ex-wife into a drug stupor, but Sledge finds strength to go on. The death of Sledge's daughter was obligatory in this sense. Suppose Horton Foote had written this scenario. A friendless alcoholic, Sledge, wakes up one morning with nothing to live for. He meets a woman, falls in love, likes her kid and wants to raise him, finds religion and writes a new tune. Fade out. This isn't a story, it's a daydream. If the quest for meaning has brought about a profound inner change in Sledge, how is Foote to express this, not through declarations of a change of heart. Self-explanatory dialogue convinces no one. It must be tested by an ultimate event, by pressure-filled character choice, the crisis or obligatory scene, and then action, the climax of the last act. As a rule of thumb, the first major event of the central plot occurs within the first 25% of the telling. It could be the very first thing that happens. Within the first 2 minutes of On the Waterfront, Terry unwittingly helps gangsters murder a friend. Or, much later, 27 minutes into Taxi Driver, a teenage prostitute, Iris, jumps into Travis Bickle's taxi. The location of the central plot's inciting incident is found in the answer to this question. How much does the audience need to know about the protagonist and his world to have a full response? In some stories, nothing. If an inciting incident is archetypal in nature, it requires no setup and must occur immediately. The first sentence of Kafka's Metamorphosis reads, "One day Gregor Samsa awoke to discover he'd been changed into a large cockroach." Kramer versus Kramer. A wife walks out on her husband and leaves her child with him in the film's first 2 minutes. It needs no preparation, for we immediately understand the terrible impact that would have on anyone's life. Other inciting incidents may need more time to prepare, for every story world and cast are different, every inciting incident a different event located at a different point. If it arrives too soon, the audience may be confused. If it arrives too late, they may be bored. Bring in the central plot's inciting incident as soon as possible, as soon as it will get a proper reaction from the audience, but not until that moment is ripe. What quality of action must the inciting incident be? Henry James wrote brilliantly about the art of story in the prefaces to his novels, and he asked, "What, after all, is an event?" An event, he said, could be as little as a woman putting her hand on the table and looking at you that certain way. In the right context, just a gesture and a look could mean, "I will never see you again," or "I will love you forever," a life made or broken. The quality of the inciting incident must be germane to the world, characters, and genre surrounding it. Once conceived, the writer must concentrate on its function. Does the inciting incident radically upset the balance of forces in the protagonist's life? Does it inspire in him the conscious desire for that object, material or immaterial, he feels would restore the balance? In a complex protagonist, does it also bring to life an unconscious desire that contradicts his conscious desire? Does it launch the protagonist on a quest for his desire? Does it raise in the audience's mind the major dramatic question? Does it project an image of the obligatory scene? If it does all this, then it can be as little as a woman putting her hand on the table, looking at you that certain way. The climax of the last act is far and away the most difficult scene to create. It's the soul of the telling. If it doesn't work, the story doesn't work. But the second most difficult scene to write is the central plot's inciting incident. We rewrite this scene more often than any other. So here are some questions to ask that should help bring it to mind. What is the worst possible thing that could happen to my protagonist? How could that turn out to be the best possible thing that could happen to him? Kramer versus Kramer. The worst? Disaster strikes the workaholic Kramer when his wife walks out on him and her child. The best? This turns out to be the shock he needed to fulfill his unconscious desire to be a loving human being. Or, turn it around. What's the best possible thing that could happen to my protagonist? How could it turn out to be the worst possible thing? Death in Venice. Von Aschenbach has lost his wife and children to the plague. Since then, he's buried himself in his work to the point of physical and mental collapse. His doctor sends him to the Venice Spa to recuperate. The best? There he falls madly, helplessly in love, but with a boy. His passion for the impossibly beautiful youth, and the impossibility of it, leads to despair. The worst, when a new plague invades Venice, and the child's mother hurries her son away, von Aschenbach lingers to wait for death and escape from his misery. The impact of the inciting incident creates our opportunity to reach the limits of life. It's a kind of explosion. In action genres, it may be in fact an explosion. In other films, as muted as a smile. But no matter how subtle or direct, out of this upheaval, you must find at climax a resolution, for better or worse, that rearranges this universe into a new order. The second of the five-part design is its progressive complications, the great sweep and body of story that spans from inciting incident to crisis climax of the last act. To complicate means to make life difficult for protagonists. To complicate progressively means to generate more and more conflict as they face greater and greater forces of antagonism, creating a succession of events that passes points of no return. When the first gap opens, the audience realizes that this is a point of no return. Minimal efforts won't work. The character can't restore the balance of life by taking lesser actions. The character must then take a more difficult action, requiring more willpower, putting him at greater risk and jeopardy. When he does, and that does not succeed in getting him what he wants, the audience realizes that even moderate actions won't get the character what he wants. When the character then must take more extreme actions and they do not succeed in getting him what he wants, then the audience realizes even these more difficult, more extreme actions will not work. In other words, we cannot go backwards. We cannot retreat to lesser actions. We must constantly top the previous actions, in that sense, passing points of no return. The protagonist then steps out of the inciting incident and enters a world governed by the law of conflict. To wit, nothing moves forward in a story except through conflict. Writers who cannot grasp this truth, the truth of conflict, writers who have been misled by the counterfeit comforts of modern life into believing that life is easy once you know how to play the game, these writers give conflict a false inflection. The scripts they write fail for one of two reasons, either a glut of banal conflict or a lack of meaningful conflict. The former are exercises in turbo special effects, written by those who follow textbook imperatives to create conflict, but because they're disinterested in or insensitive to the honest struggles of life, devise overwrought excuses for mayhem. The latter are tedious portraits, written in reaction against conflict itself. These writers take the Pollyanna view that life would really be nice if it weren't for conflict.